assumption that the federal money isn't available. What does it hurt to do this? I mean, does it cost us a subsidy or?
No.
There's probably three utilities maybe that would fall between a 10-20.
I would move and ask unanimous consent for Senator Sturgiolowski, Act as Chairman of the Free Conference Committee on Senate Bill 148.
Well, no objection.
No objection. Carries. And all members of the House conferees are present, as well as the Senate. We had some discussion as to how we could best proceed in an orderly fashion, and a decision has been made to allow for some analysis of the differences between the two bills and to come back at 3 p.m. Is that going to be satisfactory, Representative Meekins-Smith, on your side?
Yes, I think the time is probably okay.
Representative Hayes.
I may have a conflict, but I'm not here. I'll have someone sitting in for me. What is it?
All right, what we're talking about is what I'd like to do is to run through just very quickly so we can start to perhaps get some of the likes and the differences in our mind, some of the differences that we will have based on analysis that Mill Barker did for Representative Meekins. Basically, in discussing this with Representative Meekins, it seems appropriate if we can have staff, including your staff, take a look at the changes, the differences in HFC and the non-conforming housing loan based on your bill, the ADA based on the vehicle that we've developed. Representative Hayes, a comment on that?
Yes. We're going to come back in at 3 o'clock. We think that would be adequate time for...
Representative Hayes, I rather think it's going to be extraordinarily difficult in order to do that. And, Representative Hayes?
I might just, for whatever it's worth, but as you know, Madam Chairman, we are on the adjournment countdown here. Probably have maybe about 4 days at most to go. It's our concern that we get some kind of bill. I would say that if we quickly reconvene at 3 o'clock, there is a considerable difference between the House version or what we are advocating, what you're advocating. It would be my position that I would discharge our committee and just start over again. That's all the comment I have.
Fine. Any other
I'm not sure that it makes any difference. And the reason I'm not sure it makes a difference is I haven't read the other bill. But the normal process in free conference is you have two bills, and if you don't have agreement on accepting one or the other, you start with a blank piece of paper and you write a bill. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to me that that's, I don't know if I misunderstood you when we were talking privately or not. However a sectional analysis comes in terms of comparing the two bills, it doesn't matter which bill is taken as a base bill. You're emphasizing the differences. So,
right.
So what we're going to have at 3 is something that explains the differences between the bills, right?
That's correct.
And then we're going to proceed from there.
That's correct. Why don't we go over just briefly, if there's no objection, to kind of where we are. And I'm very cognizant of the time pressure, Representative Hayes, if you'll recall. We have been doing, ever since the pre-conference was committed, substantial work on our side, and have just gotten news very recently of your conferees, and we certainly realize, I'm sure I speak for everyone, of the importance of a bill, and we're here to work and take it every time it may be necessary to do that. We've had substantial input, so we're not coming in just there will be some areas of policy differences, there always are, and I hope that we can address those as we hit the areas of difference. I would like to point out that on HFC, the authorization for second mortgages for either home purchase or home improvement, the same. Interest rate, and I'm reading from yours and then making our comment, the interest rate, the same for first mortgages, no, but we're very close to that. The subsidized portion of the loan equal to $90,000 less any outstanding first mortgage balance, the same. The Rogers ratchet interest rate, yes, slightly modified, starting at 10%, yes. Gradual adjustment upward to 3% below the corporation cost of funds, yes. In no case less than 10% unless corporation cost of funds is less than 10%, yes. Authorization for board meetings by electronic media, yes. Annual report to the legislature, including a summary of past efforts and future plans, yes. Legislative intent that the corporation study second mortgages before implementing. I believe that was in your letter of intent, and HFC has done a lot of work in that area. The automatic extension of prior bond authorization in absence of legislative action, no. HFC to pay a higher servicing fee for loans in rural areas. Yes, but we added permissive language on that area. In ADA, the authorization increased to 400 million, yes. The automatic extension of prior year bond authorization, no on that one. Loans purchased with bond proceeds being held in the enterprise development fund, 10% bank participation at the minimum required. Yes, we modified that. I think the difference there is in the area of government guaranteed. We modified it to government guaranteed at 100%. 20% participation for moral ob on loans over a million, yes. No moral ob over 10 million, yes, slightly modified from where you were. Maximum loan, 7,500,000 or 75% of project cost. We're very close on that issue. A no, however, on ADA to establish income limits for project applicants for loans purchased from bond proceeds. No on that. Small enterprise account will use ADA assets and cash flow to purchase loans for one, working capital, inventory refinancing up to 500,000, which are federally guaranteed. The interest rate is tax exempt rate. Yes, but we did modify that slightly. We're going to have Lieutenant Governor Miller wants to address us on that particular issue. New multi-family rental and cooperative housing of three or more units up to 50,000 per unit or 3 million per project. The interest rate is greater than the Rogers ratchet. That's reading from your analysis. ADA can do, but not on that particular fund in the proposal that we have. Other small enterprise projects that tax exempt rate, and I believe we have a no on that one. The one of the things we think we're going to have to talk about is the amount of cash in this whole thing, what we're going to possibly need for appropriation. Letter of intent giving working capital and inventory loans first priority on 2 million cash flow from existing ADA assets and allocating 30% thereof to such loans which are less than 100,000. We're out on that one. Definition of small enterprise, including the telecommunication utilities with gross income less than 20 million. Out on that, but the way we have worded our bill on that section, it will give very few benefits to the small enterprise in that area, so we'll need to take a look at that. Under non-conforming, construction loans only to intended occupants, yes. No more than 20% of non-conforming loans may be in urban areas. We took that out. Interest rates equal to the Rogers ratchet, in effect no subsidy for amounts greater than 90,000, yes. Higher servicing fees for loans in rural areas, yes, but slightly modified. Intent that CRA originate loans only if there's a demonstrated lack of service available prior to January 1982. We had some suggestion, and there's not unanimous on the committee, to move that up to July 82 to allow the CRA to really do a good job to find out whether or not banks could. In other words, we did not want to encourage direct loans if that could be handled through banks. Appropriations, you spoke to this in the letter of intent. And we'd like some discussion on the fiscal bill that will go with this. As I understand it, and I'd like some correction, we have a fiscal bill of $40 million for the non-conforming. It's our understanding from Community and Regional Affairs that if that amount were to pass, they would like $2 million in the operating loss reserve account and $200,000, I think I'm correct on those figures, for the restricted title loss. Can you discuss those two issues? Yeah, those were ones that came up. Then we understood that $8 million has been made available or through HB 50 for the small business loans. The $15 million for reserve funds had not been. That had been in the governor's capital budget. And had you had any discussion on funding?
Reserve funds for which? For the non-conforming?
That would have been on ADA, and $8 million was made available for small business loans on HB 50, but nothing on the $15 million for reserve funds. Did we have discussion on that?
No.
Okay. I think we need to perhaps get a little more information on that, and just how far the cash flow from that $166 million can stretch, and we can get Milt Barker to take a look at that. Basically, I think those are the major areas. We'll come back with an analysis as soon as we can. Let's indicate.
In response to your suggestion of reconvening at 3 o'clock, I'm sitting here thinking about
what commitments I have. We're going back into session at 5:15. We have meetings with the Senate prior to that, and leadership meetings starting at 2:30.
7 p.m.?
7 p.m. we go back in this. 7 p.m. would be fine.
All right.
That would be good.
And we'll have everything before us. We'll have Milt Barker. Your staff can work with ours. We'll have a difference between the two, and we can proceed the way to move through. And I think, frankly, when we get through, we're going to have a darn good bill. I'm really, I've had some excellent staff work. I think we can, we'll come to a point where we have to resolve the basic differences.
We'd have to, at 9 o'clock, we're going to be reconvening again. We're going to go from 5 to 7.
Okay, so why don't we go from 7 to 9, and then we could set a time at your convenience, 5 o'clock tomorrow morning?
Seven, huh?
No, I said, I told you it's 5 tomorrow morning. You didn't respond to
me. I assume that it would be 3 to 5 more.
Policy questions are on the last page, because it does appear that if we can resolve those issues, we can probably move through the rest of it. There's two potential approaches. One is to make us feel like we're getting somewhere by going through all the easy ones and then hold the last ones. I think we'd rather go right to the issues and hear what the position of the Senate is and have us tell you what our position is and see where we can compromise if possible or whatever.
No problem on that.
That would be on page 4, or the last page.
Why don't we go to the last page, and we have the three staffs here who have worked on this, and I wonder if we could just start under question 1. We were talking about the umbrella bond limit. The your figure was 10. We are suggesting 1 million. I wonder if you could lead us to the appropriate places in the the two bills. Do you have both 148 and the free conference and House Committee substitutes on that. Do you have both the bills there?
I need the free conference bill.
Do you have an extra one?
Yes, free conference. So there's two. Free conference bills.
Okay, further, just we correct here now. The one is a it says work draft week on the top. It's Asper with a check, and it says free conference CS for Senator 138.
That's correct.
And the other one is the House CS for CS.
That's correct.
Madam Chairman, the Senate version, the section that deals with this is page 17, section 31, line 8.
Okay.
House doesn't exactly spell out the umbrella bond limit. You only speak to it in terms of capital reserves funds, which is a moral obligation, which umbrellas automatically have a moral obligation. So you sort of speak to it indirectly. You didn't really take a firm position on it.
Senator Rooney.
Mr. Kelly, we've discussed this position on the Senate side. Could you go ahead and elucidate to the House members the Senate's proposed compromise position with regard to this matter?
Yeah, I think there is one.
Well,
what was the number again?
Section 36.
Mr. Kelly.
We have been working on this bill for several months in the form of 404. And the latest version of that we had before the House acted had a limit on umbrellas of $1 million and also had a limit on moral obligations of $1 million. That is, capital reserve fund could not be applied if the project cost more than $1 million. When the House passed their bill, there was a compromise that you proposed, which was that moral obligation be over $1 million if there was bank participation 20%. Our bill includes that allowance, but still holds firm on the $1 million for umbrellas.
In other words, if there's the standalone carries the moral law, but we're limiting the umbrella to $1 million. Representative Meekins.
Well, the way I see the question, of course, is the moral obligation is the thing that really makes a difference in the bond market. The umbrella is only an attempt to spread out fixed costs over a large number of people, right? You have certain fixed costs when you go to the bond market. So you combine everybody into one umbrella, and all that does is just make each individual pay fewer fixed costs or just a portion of the fixed costs instead of taking 100% of them. So it's absolutely a really good idea for the smaller issues, it would seem to me, because they're the ones where that fixed cost would be a high percentage of the amount that they're getting from the bond market. The larger the issue, the less that probably is a complication. But I don't understand, so I'm not totally opposed to that, but we were only attempting to facilitate, you know, wherever possible for the borrower, if they could put four or five $2 million ones together and it didn't hurt anything, go ahead. The real policy question is whether or not you give the moral obligation to those, I believe. So I don't feel real strong about that, but I would like to know why it is that we don't want to let them go together. I don't really understand why you would not want to let them go together.
I don't think there's any objection to letting them go together. The small bonds would not be saleable without a moral obligation. The question is, I think absolutely not be saleable without a moral obligation. Right. I won't buy them. The question is, what is an agreeable compromise that will protect the public, but yet promote business? And I think I state the Senate position correctly when I say that if we allow 20% bank participation, that forces a market and a reality test. And by virtue of that, the Senate would be agreeable to go up to $10 million for moral obligation.
But you're talking about standalones?
Yes.
Senator McKay, do you have any comment?
Well, as I understand, the only area of difference then at this moment, right, assuming that was a compromise before us, we would be essentially agreeing on when and how moral obligation gets put on. It's automatic for under $1 million, and it's got to have 20% over that. But we have at least a temporary disagreement. I'm not saying I disagree, I'm just saying,
yeah,
to be correct, is that the difference is that you're saying that anything over $1 million goes on a standalone basis, and we have sort of implicitly allowed them to be combined by not prohibiting it. Is that accurate?
Representative, because that's accurate. And of course, it gets into a judgment call on this, but I think it gets into a bit on the, really down to a philosophical point. It's very difficult to measure exactly what you're talking about with moral law and what the implications might be back to the state. We can sit here and we can judge, well, it'll do this or it'll do that. We don't know. So I think what we're doing at this point is taking, in some cases, and I think this is a good one, a somewhat more conservative view than your position in saying that you're going to take that project on its merits as opposed to a number of them, and you're going to test that particular position. I think that's the thing. Your point is well taken, that you would, in fact, save some costs if you were to go under the umbrella program. But it's that somewhat uncertainty as to what you're involving the state in. I think that's a key issue. Representative Case.
Madam Chairman, as I understood the difference between the using the moral obligation of the state versus the standard was a testimony from the ADA administration indicated that there really was they really had not been too successful with this with the standalone market, and that in fact, although certain Alaskan corporations had good earning records, had good net worths, and all of the other criteria that would indicate they were a strong company, because they were not a company that was maybe had some national recognition or had recognition in the bond market, standalone bond sale just simply hadn't been working. So the approach we took in writing the House bill was that we wanted to be able to expand the loan limit up to a total loan of $10 million and use the moral obligation of the state. Then we got into a discussion about the risk that, to the state and other negative aspects of that expansion, and we then decided that if you go over the $1 million present limit, you'd have to have 20% bank participation, and that would be a test. You know, if the bank's going to go in, you're going to come up with 25% equity, 20% bank participation. There'd be very little risk to state in terms of the moral obligation. That's sort of where we were coming from. Now, you're talking about standalones and moral obligations and umbrellas. If the difference is that you're saying that the thing over $1 million doesn't have the moral obligation, then there's a big difference.
Representative Hayes, no, it was the moral on standalones over $1 million with 20% bank participation. Is that correct? Representative Meekes.
Chairman, would it be allowed for me to ask a question to some of the...
Well, we certainly hope so, that they're here, and that's what we're working through.
I would like to ask the three of you, Sterling and...
I wonder, why don't you bring your chairs up a little closer, because we're going to have other issues I think that are important.
Commissioner.
I hope we can make this an informal kind of a work session, because what we want are programs that work and do the best for the state. So
my question is your opinion on the effects of this compromise. And the reason I say that is I think I remember someone saying that the purpose of the umbrella was to spread out the fixed costs, but it did not really have any effect on the viability in the bond market of each separate issue that might be under the umbrella, because they still were taken separately by the bond market. Now, I think the concept that is implied by this compromise is that if you roll things under umbrella, just that alone, not talking about the moral obligation, just the fact that they're rolled under an umbrella increases, you know, pulls the weaker ones with it. And I'm wondering if that is the case, over $1 million, whether or not that's actually going to be the case, because I was not of that impression when we talked before. I just asked the commissioner first, and then we'll go right through.
I'm sorry, I missed part of the question.
Okay, well, let me try to restate it more simply. You have two things, the moral obligation and the umbrella. It was my understanding that it was the moral obligation that made a difference to the bond market in terms of the viability of each individual project, and that the umbrella makes, whether or not something goes standalone or under an umbrella, makes no difference, ceteris paribus, right? If everything else is the same, that alone makes no difference, except in regards to the cost to the individual. But the bond market isn't more likely to accept a project because it's rolled into an umbrella than if it were standing alone. Their question is whether or not the moral obligation is on it.
Well, in the under $1 million program, you have three things that work in favor of the borrower there. You have, for one, the pooling of the costs, which helps him save the essentially fixed costs that's mm-hmm. a shared rent.
Right.
Number two is you have pooling of collateral. There's, you know, the coverage for the bonds. We pledge out of $166 million portfolio to cover that. And that's equal to half the amount of the bonds that we issue. So if we had, for instance, an $18 million bond issue of umbrella bonds, there would be actually $27 million worth of loans securing that issue. And it's that pooled credit, not just the loans that are made with the 18, but also with the $9 million that provides credit. And in addition to that, there is the moral obligation of the state that's also associated. And all three of those things work to lower the interest cost or cost of borrowing to the customer.
Well, that's not my question, though. My question is whether, I'm talking about the bond market's perspective and whether or not they would agree to purchase bonds for a project. Is it going to make a difference to them whether it stands alone or whether it's under an umbrella if everything else is equal? That both in both cases has the moral obligation and all that. And from the bond market's perspective.
And it had the same reserves behind it, that extra coverage, that 50% extra.
Well, would it have that in a standalone? I'm not sure it would. I mean,
no, it wouldn't, but you're posing that all things be equal.
All right, I think the question, Representative Meekins, wouldn't it be between, all right, we're talking now of the idea of moving the umbrella limit to $10 million and with 20% participation versus standalones with 20%. That's what you're trying to do, is to deal with the proposal, not the $1 million umbrella that we already have in the
only difference I'm trying to isolate, okay, I'm trying to hold everything equal except the difference of the umbrella, whatever comes with the umbrella or not, right? Standalone versus umbrella, above $1 million. That's the issue here. We've agreed on everything else. What difference does that make in terms of the viability of the project to the bond market?
It's slightly stronger with the umbrella. Because you do have the moral obligation with the umbrella.
No, you have the moral obligation with standalone too. Say, assuming you did.
Everything's the same.
Well, we'll let Sterling start trying first.
It's the difference between double B and A rated credit. It's that much difference. It's a huge difference. Because what you got going with the umbrella, you have $100 million net worth test from the authority. You have 150% coverage, so every dollar of debt service is covered by another 50 cents. You have a cross-collateralized reserve of 15% in cash, and then you have the moral obligation of the state on top of that. Moral obligations of the state are designed, have always been designed by in every one of our authorities, never to be used. So, to give you an example, every time you sell $1 million of bonds with that umbrella, you have another $500,000 of assets, earning cash, that in case that loan defaults, it's there to be kept. You also have 15% in cash staying by U.S. government securities there to be used. So you have to have defaults in the range of 65% to 70% of your portfolio in order for the moral obligation to ever be called.
One of the problems, and we might get a comment on that, if we were to go under the umbrella cap, was, and you spoke somewhat to that, but a direct question, and perhaps to the commissioner on this. If you had in an umbrella a major default of one of those, what impact would that have then on the total issue? I think that's certainly one of the things we were concerned about, and I believe, Eric, you brought that up, and there's some, that's where you get into this difficulty of judging.
I think that maybe we're getting into a semantic problem. We use this term standalone and umbrella, and they're nice shorthand terms. If we're talking about simply repeating the first bond issue that was issued in May 17,
740, thank you very much,
with all the same security provisions, and I think that's what Representative Meekins was talking about, but increasing the size of the issues that can be sold on that day above $1 million, if that is the issue, then the one issue that really, to me, is important under those circumstances, and I think the credit people would subscribe to this, is the potential possibility of the project significantly more detrimental to the state than simply combining on one day, then the whole question of the ability to have the moral obligation on over $1 million. I'm not sure there's a real issue here, Mr. Chairman, as I understand it.
That's why
I honestly think when we get all the way through the numbers, there's not a real issue.
Representative Meekins, on question one, we're willing to go the House position on this, and I accept a motion to that effect, with the 20%, with the idea that make this available for a year and possibly come back and take a look at it. There's been, as I say, basic concern on what implications we have for the state. I don't think that we can sit and we can get views in both ways. So I would appreciate a motion to that effect.
Madam Chairman, I move that...
Representative Meekins made a motion to that. Is there any other clarification we need on the part of staff on that as to the...
Madam Chairman, the question, do you intend to officially address the question of reviewing this next year in a letter?
I would, if you don't agree to that, to put in a letter of intent that we will review the conditions of that next year. I think that's an excellent idea. Representative.
1 year, you're talking about 1 year from today, more or less?
I would say the next session of the...
during the next session.
During the next session of the legislature.
But not prior to, so how about not prior to April 15th, because if you get any... We really don't have much of a test.
Well, you can write the letter of intent to indicate that once you try the program, you have information on it and review it. Maybe they won't start it for 7 or 8 months or something. You know.
That may be, and it may be immediately available. I suspect that this whole package will be back before us in certain elements for review.
Because if you say in a year, like, obviously, you can take that long to get the thing going and everybody's function. Okay.
Representative Meekins, you're satisfied with the letter of intent on that and your motion. Then I'll call for the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. Carries.
Madam Chair.
The Senator.
One question along that line that goes through my mind. Would ADA have the ability to umbrella proposals between $1 million and $10 million? That didn't carry the good faith of the state, but they have that ability. Without that 20% in there in good faith, would they have the ability to go forward with, say, a package of 10 loans that were just going out there, an umbrella would stand on by themselves out there and carry no good faith to the state?
Yes.
I would assume they did, but I just was curious.
Could someone respond to that? Commissioner Williams?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yeah, that's in 4488090H, the existing law. Allows the authority to combine for purposes of a single offering bonds financing more than one project under the chapter. The way it reads now, there is no limitation on that, so we couldn't. It would only be whether there was the moral obligation or not that would attach would depend on whether there was the 20% participation.
Right.
I'd like to bring up one matter dealing with this, and it would deal with a letter of intent. I'd like to read some suggestive wordings. One of the problems on the umbrella bond, the Internal Revenue Code, talking about the 3 years behind and the 3 years ahead and how they can throw this whole status into some question. If I could read this to you and see if this is something that you might consider acceptable. If a financing is secured by the moral obligation of the state or by the general assets of the authority, and if the borrower is subject to capital spending restrictions in order to maintain tax-exempt status of that financing, ADA shall require the borrower to provide annual certified audits to the board, and the condition of those audits shall be to verify compliance with the IRS capital spending restrictions.
If the experts have no disagreement with that,
Sterling?
They already have to file an IRS statement with the IRS.
All right, we're talking about making it to the industrial ADA.
Yeah, they would also have to file it.
No objection in any case.
All right. Would you mind making that motion?
I would move that the committee adopt as part of the letter of intent, which I expect to get longer, what you just read.
Mm-hmm. Call for the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. Carries. Anything else on that particular subject, because that's a big one. Let's go on to the next big one. How to finance projects under $150,000 which qualify for tax-exempt financing. And you're saying bonds, we're saying with cash. I wonder if staff might take us to a Senator Lilly.
I was going to suggest perhaps the commissioner speak to that problem. In fact, I think he.
Fine. I wonder if we might find the pertinent sections and then.
I don't believe it's really addressed in the House bill. In the Senate bill, it's addressed on page 20, on line 21.
I would like to have the issue defined a little bit more for me.
And also on page 22, line 14. And very shortly, the issue is simply whether or not it makes sense to go to the trouble of bonding for projects that are under $150,000. And I think the commissioner was the one that brought that to our attention in the first place, and that's why we even suggested.
Madam Chair,
Representative Meekins,
how do you treat it? You say
We say that's you raise money in the taxable market, in the taxable market, and then subsidize it down with your cash flow, or just pay for it right out of pocket in the first place.
You say just pay it out of the cash flow.
Or raise it in the taxable market. That's the other opportunity.
Commissioner, do you wish to speak briefly on that?
Yeah. What we found in the first bond issue was that we had one series of bonds in there for a loan of $15,000, and there were a number of others that were came under this. And we found really that the price of the candle is not worth burning it for people under a certain size to go through the elaborate process of issuing taxes and bonds for them. In terms of the dollar volume, this only represents about 5% of the amounts of dollars that would be loaned under the program. In terms of the number of applications, though, it's about 28% of the applicants. Of course, that stands to reason. They're smaller size, so a large number of applicants and a smaller percentage that's being affected by this. We believe that, and it was a recommendation of the authority, that for people who otherwise qualify for tax exempt finance, that they be funded out of cash of the authority, out of cash flow of the authority, rather than making them go through the elaborate procedures of the bond sale, even the number of bond sale.
Representative.
So I'd like to ask Mike Dugan a question. Didn't we cover that in our provision that anything under $500,000 was taken out of the cash flow? And how is this different than what we were talking about with the Buckle amendment?
No, we didn't. If we take a look at the House Committee substitute at the bottom of page 17, beginning on line 26.
I'm sorry, Mike. What was that?
I'm sorry. The bottom of page 17, beginning with line 26, we're under that line language. What the House bill does is it anticipates that everything but SBAs, that is federally guaranteed loans for sure the purposes that are specified, will be bonded. What this language requires is that, with the exception of those loans, all other loans that are made in anticipation of bonding. What the Senate bill does is it anticipates that under a certain level, that is $150,000, certain kinds of loans which in the authority's determination could be bonded, won't be. They'll simply be purchased out of the cash flow of the authority. I believe that's the fundamental.
That's
it. Let me raise the point. Last year, in the very free conference committee, or rather its equivalence last year on Senate Bill 1, we eliminated a small loan program for a variety of reasons. There has been increasing concern on behalf of the public that there really is no real small loan program for small entrepreneurs. The Senate approach would remedy that deficit, and I would highly recommend it.
Representative Meekins and then Representative Pace.
Okay, now, I'm not sure I'd be opposed to this, but I just don't think I understand it yet, and I probably will be when I understand it, but does this do any damage to, there's only so much cash flow, and we were thinking about using that for these federal guaranteed ones. Now you're talking ones that either can't or don't have that federal guarantee, but are under $150,000. I think that might even be an improvement, but what is it? Is it going to take up all of the cash flow, just this little program? And what about the other concept that we had, which is the ones that were guaranteed by the federal government?
It's probably well directed to them, but they haven't made very few loans under $150,000 to this point. They are going to be making a lot of those SBAs. They could use their entire cash flow on the SBAs, which are ones that don't qualify for tax-exempt financing. So if we are going to allow them to pay with cash, I think the long and short of it is, yes, they're going to have to give more money.
Commissioner Williams, can you speak to that?
The volume of loans that would qualify for tax exempt status that would be under $150,000 probably would be $10 to $15 million in that range of magnitude in a year. This is, it's important to bear in mind there is a distinction here. We've got two types of small loans, if you will. You have loans that are still for capital projects. And those capital project loans qualify for taxes and bonds. Then you have sort of, if I can continue sort of an analog, it's like an operating budget loan that is SBA guaranteed, which unfortunately means we don't have that in other places. The SBA guarantee is the one that the House has addressed, and is provided for to be funded also out of the cash flow, which is about $2 million a month or $24 million a year. So you are having, you are running into problems of the same dollars being counted on two different jobs.
That was exactly the point I was going to raise on the representative. Meekins raised. It seems like we're competing for the same dollars. Our bill was addressing what had been identified by a member of the House as the need for small loans for inventory, small businesses, and that sort of thing. And it was anticipated that $2 million per month cash flow would go to buy the SBA guaranteed portion of these small business loans, put down to $5,000, $1,500, small stuff. Now we're talking about $24 million a year. We're talking about now using up 10 to 15 million of that. So we're talking about not only half as much available. There was testimony, I believe, to the effect that we could use about, to really address this market in terms of buying up the guaranteed portion of SBA loans and sort of freeing up the opportunity for people to borrow, for people who get involved in business loans. It takes about $60 million a year. So what we're doing is I think we're compromising at least what we considered an area of concern in terms of business loans.
Commissioner Williams.
Thank you. The demand for the SBA loans, of course, is a function of the interest rate that they have. Right now, SBA, I think, is running about 17 or 18 million dollars a year. Is their total demand in Alaska. Of course, that's a very high interest rate. The more that's brought down, the more people can afford to meet the payments on those loans, and hence there will be greater demand. So you have kind of a trade-off on the SBA program between the interest rate you set and the demand you will expect to get in response to that interest rate. With respect to these projects that qualify for tax-exempt financing, and whether they should continue to be financed through the issuance of loans or not, one way that you could probably cut by at least a third, I would think, the amount of cash demand for it would be to lower the amount from $150,000 to just $100,000. That if they're $125,000 or $130,000 or something like that, still issue bonds for it. There's no clear demarcation here, and we have thought in the range of $100,000 to perhaps even as high as $200,000, but obviously, the higher you go, the more you're drawing on the resources of the corporation to fund those out of cash. You could save a considerable amount of cash. It's impossible to quantify exactly how much. But you could save a considerable amount of cash demand of the corporation by cutting that down from 150 to 100 and still allow the people who really need to save the time and bother waiting for an umbrella issue to still be served.
Representative.
Why don't you explain again why we want to use cash rather than bonds? Is it to save money for the borrower? Is it because these small loans affect the sale of the bond package? Or is it a great administrative cost? Or what is the problem?
Representative Hayes, just here, and then we'll certainly go with Commissioner Williams, but I think just basically that ADA can still go, as I understand, to the umbrella market with $150,000 loans. The language that we're proposing is permissive. It would let you either select the cheapest method. That would be either the issuance cost versus the subsidy cost. And in some cases, I think it would be the cost then to ADA, which of course takes away from availability of doing other things, would certainly, in some cases, would be more if you went to the umbrella bond market. Tom, is that correct, Commissioner Williams?
Yeah. The administrative cost to ADA would be higher for as those issues get smaller, proportionally you have greater administrative costs associated with it. In terms of the borrower, he's going to see probably the same interest rate. But the big thing for the borrower is he doesn't have to wait for the bond issue. He can be funded when he needs the money.
Thank you.
Representative Hayes.
There's a big policy decision here. Up to this point, ADA has not been in the primary market. Looks like with this type of language, we've just set the stage for ADA to become a bank. Before we sell bonds, people come in and put together packages, we sell bonds. We buy SBA guaranteed loans, which frees up the SBA program. But now we're going to be able to just, people just come in and apply for a loan, and they get a direct loan from ADA. I'm not inferring that fact, I'm not at all. It's not a soft loan, but on the other hand, we've suddenly gone from a from sort of one philosophy to another, it would appear here in the whole thing.
That's actually won't be the case. The loans still have to be originated by a bank. A bank has to take a 10% part of that loan, and as the originator and part owner of a portion of it, the state would only be, or in this case, actually ADA, separate corporation, would only be a secondary market, as we've all been. I agree with you that I want to keep the state or any of its corporations in a secondary role.
Well, of course, the concept of ADA is to leverage the money from the bond market, and we have made appropriations to ADA to facilitate that, but basically, we're looking at after we made those liquid asset appropriations is ADA being mostly just a facilitator between the banks and the bond market to get money into the state. And then there is the question of the cash flow. Well, the cash flow needs to be invested in something, and it's only efficient for that cash flow to be invested in the same kind of activity that we're trying to facilitate, that is making of loans. But it appears to me to be really efficient and make most sense to have that cash flow go into only those loans that that you can't make for some reason to the bond market, or you can't get money from the bond market, which is what we were talking about in this working capital and other kinds of loans. But of course, then you bring up the question, well, we don't want to make this cash flow go into something that's not a very worthy credit, so we backed it up, had to have an SBA guarantee. So it's, what we're really doing is converting the assets now, which are illiquid assets of sort of mediocre quality, into top flight quality SBA guaranteed loans, and using that to back up the bond market. So it's a facilitation, and it is consistent, I think, with the basic philosophy. If you start making loans, even though they're in a secondary market situation, I mean, you're buying them from the banks, but if you start using your cash flow to make loans which qualify to go to the bond market, particularly the tax exempt market, it seems to me that's really a big difference.
Commissioner Williams?
Thank you. To some extent, we're double counting the demand here, which I just realized, but I asked earlier the question. The SBA can guarantee loans for the depreciable assets as well as for the working capital. So, to some extent, we're double counting demand because the people in the under $100,000 category could, presumably, get an SBA guarantee for their projects.
So what are you saying in terms of the demand that you put out and,
It simply boils down to the question of the interest rate for those people who would have a capital asset to hope to acquire, a depreciable asset. That would qualify for tax-exempt financing ordinarily. It would get a tax-exempt rate. Mm-hmm. If they're purchased under the SBA guarantee program, if the SBA guarantee is not down to the same level of subsidy or there is no subsidy, then there is an anomaly in treatment because those people could have gone for the tax exempt bonds, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Sterling, and then Representative
There's other statistics. Tom gave you statistics on the 150,000. On the 100,000 of the authority, it drops from 28% of the applications down to 25%. The cash drops from 5.4 down to 3.1 of the dollar loan.
Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Our recollection is that during the testimony we had a couple of weeks ago in developing the House bill, was testimony to the effect that SBA loan, people, by buying the guaranteed portion of SBA loans, therefore freeing up the SBA program, people would pay more money. But, you know, it wouldn't be at, say, the subsidized rate of 12% or whatever, it would be at 15-17%, but still at an affordable rate. And for uses that were precluded under the ADA program, yet there's no risk to the states. It does open up an area that we've never dealt with since we cut off the small business loan program. At the same time, by buying the SBA portion, guaranteed portion, my recollection also that there was testimony that this would tend to enhance our bond rating. So there's a twofold thing. And you know, after lengthy exploration and debate on this issue, it was concluded that, at least when we're working on a bill, that the way the House is going was the way to go.
Thank you.
Representative Meekins.
I think our concern was we had two separate issues. One is protecting the bond rating and the quality of the assets that the corporation is holding. And if you take the cash flow generated by the illiquid assets they have now and turn that into anything except, you know, you want to turn that into the highest quality loans you can. We were able to sort of accomplish two things at once, go into an area that heretofore is not being taken care of, and that really is some people consider a softer kind of loan, I guess, but that at the same time, because we required an SBA guarantee or other federal kind of guarantee, we're transforming the assets and improving those the quality of those assets. So it made sense from a from the bond market perspective, and it also facilitated certain kinds of loans that otherwise wouldn't happen. I would say that the House concern is with the Senate in terms of doing something in this area of 150,000 and less. In fact, we tried to say that 100,000, the 30% or one third of all this cash flow had to go between 100,000 and less. So we're interested in that area. And I guess our only thing was that we split the difference by requiring the federal guarantee, and that maybe that's where we're maybe that's the only real significant difference between us.
Well, I really think it is, and it's whether there's a market there that we're not going to be able to meet, or it's going to be at a very high cost. I think that's what it gets to, Commissioner Williams.
Yeah, thank you. The issues don't divide themselves along a dollar threshold. Mm-hmm. I mean, 100,000 or 150,000. That's not where the issue divides itself. It divides itself in the area between loans that would qualify for tax exempt financing and those that would not qualify. And then you're talking within. I mean, that's where the issues divide themselves. And we're talking about treating the same class under 150,000 or under 100,000 in the two sides. But there are different considerations there. It's brought about in part because of the tax laws. And I agree with everything that Representative Hayes said in his last remarks. I mean, this does allow the program to expand. It does allow ADA to fulfill expectations that people had of it that were frustrated because it's been for us to enter this area. At the same time, it does allow for the credit portfolio to be strengthened that's securing our bonds and providing the collateral. And that's all true about the SBA working capital or inventory loans. But what I was trying to address is back on the other side of that taxable, non-taxable. But what about the people in the small category over there, where we have found that, yes, we can do umbrella bond issues for them, but it's unusually expensive for the authority. It's delaying for them. And, you know, should that be funded out of cash so that we have less administrative expense for the authority itself and so that we can meet their needs more promptly? And that's the second category, which In the discussions in the House, really, we didn't get to discuss that category of under 150,000 or under 100,000 in the taxable, tax exempt area.
In the tax exempt, Representative Higgins.
Well, but isn't it true that most? I mean, we don't have any way of knowing, but isn't it true that most of those that would be qualified under the IRS regulations to be tax exempt and would also fulfill the requirements of the bond market test to get the so that the bond market would buy bonds for those issues, that most of those would also qualify for an SBA guarantee. Isn't that correct? I mean, they're the right size. They're probably of the high enough quality. And it seems to me that the House language covers almost all of those. And maybe you can think of an example where it wouldn't cover it, and perhaps there is one. But I'm not sure that we want to state as a policy that we're going to go ahead and use cash flow without having to require these people to go through the hoop of getting the SBA guarantee, which is only, according to testimony, a week or two to get. It's not too big a hoop, but I think it's really important to have that for the quality of the portfolio that we're holding. And because of the kind of way we looked at the compromise, yeah, you take care of this area, but you get something for it. And if you just take care of this area without getting anything for it, I'm a little reluctant. But I think that we covered most of that territory with this, it seems to me, the SBA guarantee. And maybe if there's somebody that can't get an SBA guarantee, we shouldn't. Even if they could qualify the bond, maybe we shouldn't be interested in that guy, because maybe he's the one that's going to flake out on it.
Yeah, I got a complicated answer. Our view of this credit is that is right now it's A-minus credit. These credits are viewed as lender of last resort in other states. In this state, it's the only lender. So there's a big difference in the quality of credit. But you're never going to really change the rating agency's perception that much a lender of last resort. We don't think this credit will ever get to be AA rated like we expect the housing authority to get AA rated someday. The SBA's, but that's to the rating agency. Going over to the market will appreciate the SBA's a whole lot more. So, lot stronger market perception of that SBA. Under $100,000 loan won't make any difference in that perception because it's very small amount of cash. We're talking about maybe $6, $8, $10 million a year if you move the limit down from $150,000 to $100,000.
Mr. Kelly,
if I can give a simple answer to it, both versions have money available for small projects. Both versions have SBA guarantees, although there is a dispute at what rate that's going to be. The only question we should be talking about here is whether or not it, for some cost reason, makes sense to pay these things out of cash. I mean, that's really the only question you need to deal with right here. The rest of it, I think, is superfluous. The two points you've made is that there's a delay for the borrower and it's an increased administrative cost. I think I disagree on the delay for the borrower because all the borrowers on the umbrella received money out of the cash flow of the corporation before you actually received the bond proceeds anyway. I don't think there was a delay for those people. So I think really the question is whether it makes administrative sense to do it that way, and whether or not you have any money you want to give to them.
Fine, thank you. Lieutenant Governor Miller is here, and I was going to wait for this discussion to be because he's not certainly interested in SBE, but I think, and that came into another question here, but I think it is also pertinent here. Terry, could you come forward and just tell us whatever you'd like to right now, and because I do think it has some reflection on trying to cover some of the smaller borrowers, so I'd be very happy to hear from you.
Okay. Madam Chairman, I apologize for missing that portion of the discussion.
No, we are going to be getting into the SBA. So
okay, I presume one of the, just from the moment I was here, the issue is how to treat the $150,000 borrower who does not qualify for an SBA, but for whom you do not want to go to the bond market. Would that be the issue?
Well, he may qualify for an SBA. It's on a matter of convenience and administrative cost. Basically, he's eligible for tax-exempt financing. But as a matter of convenience.
Right. But the minute he triggers SBA guarantees, he is no longer eligible for tax-exempt financing. Is that correct?
Correct.
Right. Well, I basically wanted to address just again the perceptions which I had. I know I shared them with the Senate Finance Committee based upon my travels around the state talking to literally thousands, and I do mean literally thousands of people who attended different loan fairs. And, you know, notwithstanding many of the problems you're grappling with, the loan programs generally receive pretty high marks, particularly in the area of housing, particularly in the area of some of these others, like student loans and the like. The major area of complaint which I heard, and I outlined them, were one, in terms of the small business loans, two, commercial fishing vessel loans, and three, the whole problem of multifamily units. Addressing primarily the question of the small business loan program, I can only say it's perception of people out there, that when we unplugged from the old Division of Business Loans, which was exclusively internally financed by cash, which was, as many of you know, at best, in some cases, relatively soft paper, and went over to the leveraging circumstance over at ADA, which I think was sound public policy generally, I think we overreacted, and when we totally unplugged from cash financing, we made it almost impossible for many small business people who represent the backbone of the business community in the state to get financing. I guess the remedy which I have fashioned, and it's just one perspective, I admit,